Hello and welcome to this late night primary reaction edition of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk. It's been another good night for Joe Biden. As of the time of this recording at 10:30 p.m., the races in Mississippi, Missouri, and Michigan have all been called for Biden. Michigan was set up to be the main test of the evening, a state that Bernie Sanders won in 2016, and the state with the most delegates of the evening. And as of right now, Biden is leading Sanders by 14 points there. So, as people may be able to tell on YouTube, or if the audio sounds a little bit different, we are all in our own apartments this evening recording ourselves, one, because it's late, but also because we're testing our remote capabilities. Just in case the situation with coronavirus requires us to work remotely, we're testing out our capabilities. And so here with me tonight doing that and discussing the Democratic primary, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
I'm in the frickin' office. I'm in the office exposing myself to germs.
Well, you're the one who wanted us to all work remotely.
It's because I care about your safety.
Fair enough.
I care about you guys not being disease vectors for the rest of America.
I guess that just leaves you. Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
I'm good. Apologies if you can hear my dog barking in the background.
Okay, so to start things off, Nate, is the 2020 Democratic primary over?
Don't answer that question, Nate.
Answer the question.
If I have to pick between yes and no, yes.
You don't have to pick between yes and no.
That's certainly what our model thought even before tonight. As conservative as we would like to be, we even kind of evaluated a few things and said, is this being too aggressive about Biden? When you saw Biden get actually a very big Super Tuesday bounce, and when you saw all these candidates dropped out, and that all seemed to help Biden, and then you see some version of those results confirmed in the actual voting tonight, the problem is like kind of multifold for Bernie. Number one, almost half the country has voted now, and it's clear they prefer Joe Biden to Bernie Sanders. Number two, even if something big shifted, it's probably too late. And number three, the next 14 days consist of really bad states for Bernie. He's going to lose Florida. He's going to lose Georgia. Even if Arizona and Illinois and Ohio are competitive, although you can't feel great about Illinois or Ohio based on Michigan tonight, you know, these are not states where he's going to gain ground most likely. And so, you know, you would have to have something kind of outside the scope of normal politics almost intervene, right? Something like that could happen. We have two very old candidates. There is infectious disease going around the country, right? I don't want to speculate, but like he's too far behind with too many bad states coming up and too many parts of the country having weighed in for it to be realistic in the normal state of affairs.
Disease vector Nate Silver making a lot of interesting points there.
Does anybody want to make an argument against the idea that this race is over?
No, the answer is yes. I mean, this makes me... I agree with Nate.
Claire, we have gone over to the dark side.
I don't know. I mean, so we're recording this at 10:30. We just saw that Sanders won't appear tonight to make a public statement. I think that's interesting. I don't necessarily think it means he'll drop out, but it's certainly not a confident, you know, the action of a confident candidate. But I also think it's helpful to remember in 2016, 538 became sort of a favorite target of Bernie Sanders supporters, in part because of our relentless truth about the math, right? The lack of a clear mathematical path for Sanders after a certain point in the primary to the nomination. But he stayed all the way through June in the contest. So who's to say he won't stay for a little while longer? I kind of have a hard time seeing him staying until June, barring anything really out of the ordinary happening. But, you know, there's a debate on Sunday. Maybe he'll stay in through that. I'm not sure. I mean, it was certainly not a promising night at all for Sanders.
So to jump in on this first question, I think the right answer is not to answer it as a yes or no question and instead do what we normally do and give a probability-based answer. And the answer is like what our forecast says, which is like it's all but over. It's 99-whatever% over. That said, I think we shouldn't rule out the possibility that the race gets far messier and Biden doesn't. I don't think it's over that Biden wins the nomination super cleanly, if that makes sense. To Claire's point, if something happens in the debate, I could imagine things swinging more towards Sanders, not in a way where he wins a majority of pledged delegates, but in a way where it creates a much messier narrative for presumably Biden going into the general election. So in that sense, I think there's still stuff to watch.
Okay, so the argument is that it could potentially get messy from here. You know, we don't have a model that can tell us how Sanders is going to process this information and make decisions about the future of his campaign and his political career. But, you know, what would be Sanders' reasoning for wanting to do that? Are there things at this point that are either encouraging him to stay in or get out of the race?
Well, I think what I'd say more is that, one, there are real serious policy disagreements between Sanders and Biden. There are real serious ideological disagreements between Sanders and Biden. And so there are those reasons to stay in the race. More than that, you know, one question is what Sanders does, but there's also the question of what his voters do. You know, I think in general, the kind of like storyline that conflict in a primary will hurt a candidate in a general election, those stories tend to be overblown. But we've seen like really big fault lines in the Democratic primary around age, around gender, around race. And so, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, what do young voters do in a general election? That kind of stuff could persist.
Claire, you were saying that Sanders wasn't going to appear to speak this evening. What do you make in terms of what would encourage Sanders to stay in or get out of the race at this point?
Well, one imagines that he's probably talking it through with his team. And I think that there's sort of two forces at work here, right? There are, you see a lot of people, sort of these, for lack of a better phrase, Twitter surrogates for Sanders, saying not very hopeful things about his path forward. And so there is an argument to be made for him dropping out, which is to say, the party should coalesce behind a candidate, come out early and sort of, you know, get a lot of Biden surrogates to appeal to the lots of different factions of the Democratic Party, because this was a factious and fractious primary season. So, you know, someone like Andrew Yang, who I think has a lot of crossover appeal to Sanders voters, came out and endorsed Biden on CNN. I think that's interesting. I think, you know, someone like that is a potentially interesting surrogate for Sanders supporters, kind of solving the wound. You know, on the other hand, I think it is what Micah says, which is it's real ideological differences. It's the fact that Sanders doesn't have the same fealty to the Democratic Party that the other former 2020 candidates who have dropped out and now endorse Biden do have. I think it's sort of pragmatism versus, you know, the principled stance right now. That's the decision he's sort of looking at.
I mean, okay, the problem for Bernie Sanders is that, like, this could get pretty embarrassing. If you project forward after Georgia, then you have Puerto Rico, which is an interesting state. I don't know how it's going to go. Then you have Wisconsin, some states like that. You have Kansas and Hawaii and Alaska. But, like, let's say he loses Washington tonight, which has not reported any results by the time that we are recording this, right? That starts to get pretty embarrassing. Washington should be one of the best states on the map for Bernie Sanders. He's going to lose Florida probably by 30 or 40 points, right? What if he loses Arizona? Now it seems like, oh, this Hispanic part of my coalition isn't enough for me. So there is some issue of, like, look, this race is not as close as 2016. 2016, you could kind of project where, oh, if there's a big shift, then blah, 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 it gets close. Like, Joe Biden is winning in all these places that Hillary Clinton lost to Bernie in 2016. It's a much more robust map. And so there's a risk of, like, Bernie Sanders damaging his movement by staying in too long and losing, you know, 28 of the remaining 31 states or something, right? And meanwhile, damaging potentially Biden, because voters went through this in 2016, and therefore further hurting his reputation and the movement. You know, I kind of wonder, like, if it were the West Wing or something, right?
Oh, no.
Then, oh, no.
Keep
oh,
going. No.
Then Bernie would say, hey, look, Joe, I will drop out now, but I get to pick your VP or something, right? Or consult on your VP. What's that, Claire? A lot of chuckling from all the podcasters tonight.
I'm just imagining Aaron Sorkin as consultant to the Biden campaign.
So let me jump in on that in a somewhat more serious way, which is what Nate said about Sanders' future, the future of his movement, and the VP question is interesting just because of that. Because now, if it, as Nate says, this could start to get embarrassing, and you have to sort of wonder, Sanders really has built this not a winning coalition we've seen, but a coalition and a big one, and I think it is fair to call it a movement. And so, like, what happens to that, and how distinct is the Sanders movement versus just the progressive wing of the party? Those are obviously maybe questions for a later day, but I think those are now on the table given Biden's performance Tuesday night.
I want to dig into that a little bit more, but first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process, but today hiring can be easy and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. You can even add screening questions to your job listing so you can filter candidates and focus on the best ones. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, to try ZipRecruiter for free, listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Upstart. Upstart knows you're more than just your credit score, and they offer smarter interest rates to help you pay off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional credit score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter rate. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate. And the best part, once the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 400,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards or meet their financial goals. Free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is top-ranked in their category with a 4.9 out of 5 rating on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. That's upstart.com/politics. We're back, and Nate, you just brought up the fact that this race is looking to be less competitive than the 2016 primary, which we at 538 and listeners to this podcast will remember said was not particularly competitive. What is it about Biden's coalition or Sanders' weaknesses that is making this election not competitive?
Biden's a man.
That was Micah. That was not Nate. That Biden is winning the rural, mostly white counties, also the rural, mostly black counties. You know, look at the maps. Biden is going to win. He's winning all but 2 counties in Michigan right now, all but 1 county, which is a college county in Missouri. Every county, unsurprisingly, in Mississippi. I mean, it's like kind of, if you go at least west of the, or east of the Mississippi, it's like a kind of clean Biden sweep, right? He run rural Maine, for example. Heck, actually, even in Vermont, Bernie Sanders got only, quote-unquote, 50% of the vote. He actually won Vermont by less than Biden won in Virginia. So how much that has to do with Biden versus Hillary? How much has to do with the 2016 version of Bernie versus the 2020 version? Because he has moved to his left on cultural issues, been a much more kind of like woke campaign, right? And people might kind of think, oh, before Bernie was like kind of,
it's not that, you know, different of a campaign externally.
I don't think
voters absorb it as a particularly different campaign from 2016. I think it's expanded its efforts with like black voters, for instance. It does much better than it did in 2016. But I don't think your average American voter sees a great deal of difference between the Bernie Sanders 2016 and 2020 campaigns.
I would like to see some polling on that. But, you know, yeah, look, may well also be that, like, it's hard to portray Joe Biden as a figure of the establishment. He kind of has this comeback reputation now that's hard to shake off, at least for the first couple of weeks after that occurs. He gives people kind of warm, fuzzy memories of Obama, I guess. I mean, look, we're kind of dancing around the fact that, like, this election's been consistent with an interpretation of events whereby Hillary was an underperforming candidate. And I'm choosing underperforming because that allows for multiple lanes of interpretation, ranging from she's a woman, people aren't ready for that, to she just isn't likable and that is her fault, to, I don't know, right, the way the media covered her or whatever hypothesis that you want, right? But, like, but certainly the most thing that jumps out is, like, 2016 was more about Clinton's weakness than Sanders' strength, number one. And number two, Sanders kind of assumed that, hey, we're going to kind of take what we had last time and build on it. Per our analysis, about 20% of his voters last time were people who were just never Clinton voters. And they're the ones who have fled to either Biden or not voting. You lose that part of the coalition, then all of a sudden you don't have that strong a constituency.
So did the entire Democratic Party, and maybe the broader media too, just misjudge what happened in 2016? Because after Hillary Clinton lost the race, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, a lot of the Democrats who ended up running for president all rallied around Sanders and kind of put him front and center in front of the cameras and saw him as helping them chart a path forward in, you know, Trump's America, etc. Was this all based on an assessment of the 2016 election that was wrong?
Well, no one in politics or political media has a memory that lasts longer than 4 years, right? And people endlessly in political media beat themselves up over uncertain outcomes that may have been quirky and say, oh, now the new lessons of politics are that the left is ascendant in the Democratic Party, which was not a lesson that looked very good in 2018, for example. So I kind of blame, like, media coverage that was very, and not just media coverage, also within the party, that was very nearsighted, that fixated on one interpretation that applied in one election that Clinton won anyway the nomination. And, you know, didn't look at the kind of broader sweep of history, which says that actually it probably is helpful to be the candidate who is most aligned with the kind of median Democratic voter.
I think this has been the way that the senators, we've talked about this before, but the way that the senators who ran for president positioned themselves seemed to be a fundamental misreading of how liberal the Democratic base was. And so, you know, 6 months ago, 7 months ago, when people were scoffing at Biden's both sort of presentation as sort of a moderate, not super PC guy with kind of a moderate record, people were like, "This, he's totally out of step with the Democratic Party." And their campaign kept on saying, their whole line was, you know, Twitter's not real life, blah, 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 we're doing fine. It kind of turned out to be true, right? They sort of just weathered the summer of racial controversies with Biden, got through it. You saw Pete Buttigieg, sort of the blank slate of the campaign, move from a sort of more progressive position candidate to be more of a moderate lane candidate. And I think that pivot was interesting because it seemed to be a recognition from a candidate who could pivot and decided he would, that it made political sense to do so. And I kind of wonder if some of those senators aren't kicking themselves 7 months later saying, yikes, we misjudged things.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And I think this Claire's right to point to the senators. But I guess I don't think Sanders falling short again in 2020 invalidates the storyline of kind of a rising liberal tide in the Democratic Party. Right. We have plenty of evidence to show that that's true and real.
What do you mean? This is like a pretty bad result for the left.
Well, no, sure.
Voters within the party over the past decade have increasingly identified as liberal or very liberal.
And you,
not in the exit polls this year.
And you,
maybe the moderates just not inspired by Hillary Clinton.
But couldn't also, if you're cherry picking, well, if you're taking just these the primary presidential primary results, that also ignores the past decade of those numbers from voters, and people could be doing and probably are doing some pragmatic voting, which doesn't necessarily represent their ideological interests, right? Because we've had Democratic voters from the very beginning say that they want someone who can beat Trump before they want someone who shares their ideology perfectly.
I think that's totally right. I think it's one of the simplest explanations of the primary is that the most liberal wing of the Democratic Party is not a majority. That can be simultaneously true with the liberal wing of the Democratic Party has grown in recent years. I think it's also true that, you know, okay, exit polls might say one thing, more general national polling another thing, but just like look at how Congress has behaved and voted and spoken over, you know, how that has changed over the past decades. I don't think it's really in doubt that the party has grown more liberal. Biden himself has shifted to the left over the last over this past couple of years, you know, from the Hyde Amendment and so on. So like in the same spirit of what Nate said of like a lot of the misunderstandings of the Democratic Party and electorate came from mislearning and overlearning and overcorrecting from past elections. Like, let's not go crazy in this moment and be like, oh, you know, actually the party's not gotten more liberal. There's like,
but a lot of people bent over backward. I mean, I think there are really amazing things about what Sanders has done, including being a real multiracial coalition of younger voters on the left, right? And the age thing is significant, but like he's going to wind up probably losing this primary pretty badly. I mean, I think this has turned into, and we'll see what happens next week, but potentially turned into such a landslide so quickly that like this is really bad for Bernie. He might only win like four or five states
well
against a candidate who, and we have been one of the places that will say that, hey, Joe Biden is overlooked and underrated. He is also not the second coming of Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama as a politician, right? You're losing to like a kind of competent, generic Democrat, right? Like, that's not good for Bernie. It's not, I mean, if he were winning, if we were trading punches and winning Michigan and winning Texas, right, and you lose the nomination by 100 delegates or so, that's a different story than what might wind up happening this year.
It's an interesting question. I mean, I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with someone who's, you know, an activist and a strategist on the progressive left. And I said something to the effect of, I think Bernie Sanders will probably look back and think of him as one of the more important, you know, political figures in a couple of generations. And he said, I don't know about that. So, I mean, that's kind of maybe what Nate is sort of tonight, you know, March 10th, sort of thinking about. Not necessarily that you're making that declaration, but yeah, I'm sure, you know, I take your point that people will be looking at the legacy of Sanders.
Yeah, see, now I feel like, I mean, I do feel like the legacy is going to be very significant, and he maybe have had more influence on American politics in the past 5 years of anybody not named Donald Trump. But look, the Sanders campaign very pointedly and very deliberately felt like, I mean, literally, if I go back to like the rallies I went to in Nevada and New Hampshire, they're like, we don't need anyone else. We're big enough. We just have to turn our voters out, right? The establishment. I mean, almost like Bernie didn't use the F word, but like literally in Nevada, he was like kind of trolling the establishment for not being able to get its act together, which is kind of not the traditional way that you win nominations. And there is like a little bit of like a flying too close to the sun thing, right? I mean, that's what I don't know, right? Like Occam's razor is that the left is a sizable, I mean, Micah said this, we're all agreeing, I guess. The left is a sizable but not majority part of the coalition. Therefore, you have to find out ways to reach out to people who might be sympathetic to parts of your agenda or your candidacy. And they haven't focused on that very much. And Elizabeth Warren kind of tried to, and she had other problems too. So, I mean, it's the kind of combination of Sanders' strategy seemingly failing and Warren's strategy kind of failing that like would be a little bit worrying to me if I were on the left.
So Nate, you mentioned exit polls, and a lot of the commentary in the past 2 weeks has revolved around, you know, whether or not Biden is attracting voters who used to be Kasich or Jeb Bush Republican primary voters in suburban areas. And also in some of these open primaries, of course, you can have independents or even Republican voters vote on the Democratic side. So how different is the electorate in this primary compared with 2016? Is it the same electorate to begin with? Like, is that another complication in comparing the two elections?
So I think Nate, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think it's in some of these states, it obviously depends on the state and what kind of primary the state has. But I think in a lot of these states, it's been whiter, more independent leaning, more moderate leaning, because where there are open primaries, there's not a competitive Republican election. And so that does change the baseline electorate, although Sanders does better with independents, so that's not a bad thing for him either in those states that let independents vote. But I don't know. I think that misses the forest for the trees somewhat. I saw someone was throwing around a stat that college-educated white voters in Missouri swung 55 points away from Sanders between 2016 and 2020.
I'm looking at exit polls among white men.
Yeah,
Micah, I don't know if that's, but white men in Missouri in 2016, 61% Sanders, 38% Clinton. In 2020, they're at 49% Biden, 45% Sanders.
Yeah, so I was looking at a note from Ryan Strzok, who's at CNN now, and he was pointing to white men with a college degree in Missouri. So in 2016, it's similar. In 2016, it was 64 Sanders, 36 Clinton. In 2020, it was 60 Biden, 33 Sanders. I think we already knew that a big chunk of Sanders' coalition in 2016 was more about Never Hillary than about Sanders. And I think we knew that a big part of that Never Hillary coalition was about gender. I think tonight's results, the Super Tuesday results, like, to me, is the kind of nail in the coffin of any counter argument against that. I'm not sure there were any left, but I don't know. I think that has to just be a huge explanation for part of the reason Biden is outperforming Sanders in all these places. Biden is outperforming Clinton in all these places. And I would go to an explanation like that well before I check down the list to something like, well, there's not a competitive Republican primary this year. Although I'm sure that that's a factor, you know.
All right. Well, it's starting to get late here, and we've almost, you know, started reflecting more on the primary overall than we have on tonight's results. But looking ahead to Washington, Idaho, North Dakota, Nate, what do we expect out of those races? Can we say much at this point now that the polls are closing just now in Washington?
By the time you listen to this, you may know what happens there. We don't know as we're recording this. Our model had Sanders as a narrow underdog in Washington, a somewhat bigger underdog in Idaho, and actually a decently sized underdog in North Dakota. Do North Dakota and Idaho really matter? I mean, I like Idaho. It's a nice state. We recorded a podcast there one time. Go Boise. There aren't a lot of delegates, though, but Washington might be a state where if Sanders were to lose Washington, which, again, our demographic rankings is supposed to be like the fourth or fifth best state in the country for him, then you might see calls for him to get out. I don't know. I mean, that's kind of the discussion we're having, right? Is there some miracle that brings him back to life? Okay, we can have that conversation. But otherwise, like, that kind of is conversation about, like, how long is it going to continue?
The Washington State exit poll, I guess it's a telephone poll, Nate?
Yeah, it's a telephone poll. The exit poll had Biden up a little larger than I would have thought, but also had, like, Elizabeth Warren getting a bunch of votes. And, like, I'm not totally sure that you'd treat it any more than, like, a high-quality phone poll that had Biden ahead in Washington, which the other polls did anyway. But still, I mean, that's a place that Bernie really should win, even with this new coalition and not the 2016 coalition.
Do you think his campaign is waiting for the Washington results to decide whether to stay in or not?
Maybe. I mean, I think it's pretty inauspicious that he is not speaking tonight. Look, He is also, how old is Bernie? I want to make sure I get this
78.
Right, 78 years old. So you have a 78-year-old person who had a severe medical condition last year, who has been traveling around the country, working an extremely vigorous schedule, going to rallies where he is literally in contact with thousands of people at a time when you have a epidemic disease outbreak, right? And probably most of those rallies would be shut down, but like, but at some point it's like, okay, is Bernie like going to take risks to his health by campaigning? Or, because probably they wouldn't take those risks, they both canceled rallies in Ohio tonight, is the campaign no longer feel as fulfilling if you're not able to, because these rallies are really pretty impressive things, right? They are really kind of like literally almost like produced like rock concerts or something. And like, you can imagine that like Bernie is seeing all these young people, all different races, listen to him. And like, it's gotta be really fulfilling. But if you can't have that, and if you want to have that, you're putting your health at risk, then like, that's certainly a reason to maybe leave when you would stay, if not for coronavirus.
All right. Well, we will find out soon enough what the future of Sanders' campaign looks like. We're going to leave things there for now. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room this evening. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.